Good afternoon. The court's ready to hear argument in Smith v. State. Are you ready to proceed? Very well.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely, and Justice Jacob. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with...
This is Vice Chancellor Noble who's helping us today. You should have gotten a copy of an order that appointed him to sit with us on bond.
Yes, yes. As the court knows, I'm here on for return engagement as to our original discussion back in September 20th. And the original issues before the court was whether there was sufficient evidence to find a juvenile respondent competent to stand trial, as well as whether there was knowing an intelligent voluntary waiver of Miranda back in December of 2003. Since that time, the court asked us to prepare supplemental memorandums and have this argument regarding the issue whether what's a major law in Delaware as well as other jurisdictions regarding the waiver by mentally retarded juvenile with or without a parent being present. Our review of this matter in Delaware specifically has shown that that the courts basically adhere to the Fair decision from the Supreme Court in 1979 and rely on all evaluations of whether it's either a child's mentally retarded or whether a parent is in the interrogation room under that decision, under the totality of the circumstance test. They essentially consider other factors of relevancy of whether a parent or interested adult is in the interrogation room as a factor, but it's not a factor that is determinative of the issue or is given any special weight. There doesn't appear to be any special weight separate and apart for mental retardation. There's no decision that says this should be special scrutiny when that issue is involved. All we understand is that the courts, when dealing with juveniles in Delaware, just generally apply special scrutiny as to whether the issue is of the waiver is intelligent or voluntary. Nationally, there is a predominance of jurisdictions that apply the totality of circumstance literally from the Fair decision. But there are jurisdictions that have adopted other approaches, and there are a minority of jurisdictions that follow the...
I think you identified 10 states, is that correct?
10 or 11 states. Some studies have indicated 13 states, but it appears to be along that number. There's only a minority of jurisdictions that have adopted some variation on the per se rule that recognizes that a juvenile is not sufficiently mature to waive Miranda, so therefore the presence of a parent or interested adult is required when the waiver is undertaken.
Well, in this case, if we decide to adopt the per se rule, which you're certainly free to argue, it would be a fairly easy resolution since the mother wasn't in the room. So I guess in focusing on your argument, do you want to spend some time arguing in favor of the per se rule now that we know what the minority majority distinction is? Or do you want to argue why, under the totality of the circumstances, this waiver wasn't valid?
Well, I was going to do both, but...
Great, well, okay.
Basically, it's our position that it would be advisable to consider adopting a per se rule simply because of the emergent studies that have developed over the last few years, especially since this court's opinion back in 1992 that specifically dealt with this issue, Torres. Since that time, there's been a lot of emerging studies that show that juveniles don't have the maturity to consider Miranda properly. They don't. They're too deferential to adults and authority figures when considering.
Is that some juveniles or all juveniles?
It's. I believe the studies show that there's a propensity for juveniles to do this. The exact number is that. I believe there's the studies specifically by Dr. Grisso, who's a major authority on this field, seems to indicate that 63%, as high as 63% of juveniles don't understand some, misunderstand completely some major aspect of the Miranda forms, as well as other words and aspects of the waiver when it's given to them.
Well, wouldn't that come out generally in a specific hearing on an individual defendant where individual attention is being given to the individual facts?
It can, but the problem is if you do that under the totality of circumstance test, we don't know how much emphasis the court's going to place on that. That's the problem we found that with many cases under that test is that in certain cases you'll have one case where a judge finds that that there was a juvenile that was maybe mentally impaired or didn't have the parent in the room, but then they decide there was a voluntary waiver because police officer read the Miranda warnings clearly and simply, and the juvenile did not say anything to indicate he didn't understand or had a question. And then you can have a different court review the same facts and arrive at a totally different consideration. The fact of the matter is quite often police officers don't have the ability to tell whether a juvenile is mentally impaired or has immature or understanding of Miranda. That's why it's usually advisable, based on these studies, to consider the presence of a parent in the court in the interrogation room, because they would provide relevant facts to the police officer, for example, to indicate whether this juvenile is may have some kind of mental defect or handicapped.
Why a parent and not a lawyer? I mean, what is the parent going to look at in terms of resources for giving advice to a child who's being questioned by a police officer other than their own values of, well, Johnny, we've always told you to tell the truth. Tell the police officer the truth. Tell him if you did it. How does that advance the rights of the juvenile to have a parent there saying things like that, which happens?
Admittedly, this is not a. There are problems with a parent that can emerge, but it goes some. It helps somewhat in eliminating the practice of whether there's an issue of coercion or deception. For example, when police officers tell juveniles that, "Listen, your parents said it was right for me to talk, therefore, you know." It's okay, which is a suggestion to the juvenile that they should waive Miranda. We've seen that in cases. There was a case cited by this.
So let's look at this case, since that's an issue. What's your understanding of what the police officer said to this juvenile about the attorney? When he was summarizing the Miranda rights, he said to the defendant, "I talked to your mother about it, and it's okay." Was the police officer conveying it was okay to hire an attorney if he wanted one, or conveying it's okay not to have an attorney?
Well, if the police officer is conveying that I spoke to your mom and says okay, could that mean that she wants an attorney? If that's the case, they shouldn't be proceeding with the warning. She's saying I want an attorney. It could only mean that she's stated that to the officer that attorney isn't necessary, and he's conveying that to the juvenile, so the juvenile believes that this does not, he should not invoke Miranda.
Do we know whether that was an accurate statement?
Excuse me?
do we know whether that was an accurate statement by the police officer? In other words, had he in fact spoken to the defendant's mother and said, is it all right with you if I go talk to him, and is it all right with you if he waives his Miranda rights, and she said yes?
Well, there's some dispute in the record as to that. He states, at one point he states that he just told the mother, listen, I'm going to go talk to him down the road, down the hall, and I'll be a few minutes and I'll come back. And then when there was a dispute about Miranda, he embellished his testimony and says, I did talk to her about it. She states that he didn't, and there's clearly a dispute on the record, although he does admit on the record that he never really actually read the whole Miranda rights to the mother. He just summarized it, but he didn't say specifically what he summarized. So it was difficult to gauge from the record how specific he was as to specifically the attorney issue. But if you look at it in light most favorable to the state that he did read the Miranda warnings to the mother, the implication from the record is that there's no, that the mother never turned to the child while sitting, who was sitting there, or the police officer to verify that that's okay with him to waive Miranda. Miranda isn't necessarily waived by the parent, it's waived by the child. So the fact that the officer is telling the child that your parent is waiving is okay, that you don't have to get an attorney, is clearly suggesting to the child that they should waive Miranda. That's the problem we have.
Okay, the other concern that I have is what would the standard of review be in this court as to a decision by the trial court on whether there was a knowing and intelligent waiver?
I believe the standard is abuse of discretion.
Okay, and if the standard that the trial court is to use in reaching that decision is the totality of the circumstances, then am I correct in understanding that one trial judge could give greater weight to the fact that the child is mentally retarded, another trial judge could not give that factor quite as much significance and say, well, I looked at the tape or read the transcript and I'm comfortable that this child did understand what was going on, and that it would be kind of open-ended as to what any particular trial judge would focus on and then be subject to a fairly difficult standard to hurdle on the part of the defendant to get that reversed on appeal.
I think that's probably the overriding concern about the totality of the circumstances. It doesn't give any clear direction to the police officers or the court what is unacceptable. Is this a serious consideration that the parent wasn't in there when Miranda? Is it somewhat of a serious consideration? Is it no consideration?
Okay, and following up on that, on the other side is a per se rule where nobody has to give it too much thought. Either parents there, parents not there. Parents not there, the confession is no good, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and I guess in certain circumstances that makes it all very simple. It certainly gives the police, as you say, the certainty of knowing what will be acceptable and what won't. Is there any middle ground between what I think you're suggesting is a little bit too open-ended under the totality of the circumstances test, and a case perhaps such as this one where it's not clear that the result would have been any different if the parent had been in the room? And yet, if the parent had been in the room under a per se rule, wouldn't that strongly favor a finding that the waiver was knowing and intelligent? So what I'm asking is whether either under other case law or under something that you would be in a position to formulate for the court or suggest to the court, there is some way of looking at the totality of the circumstances, but giving guidance as to what factors are the most important or what factors must be given serious consideration in evaluating it?
I think there was a case we cited from Wisconsin that recently dealt with this issue, and I believe Wisconsin law, there was a special emphasis under the totality of the circumstance test to look carefully at the issue whether the parent was in the room or not. So the court, even though they weren't applying the per se rule, they applied the totality of the circumstance test with this special factor. So it's, that court sort of followed the middle ground.
Said,
look at this. But the court found that even with this special factor, the police were still not bringing in the parent into the interrogation room. And keep in mind, Delaware does have that factor in as part of the totality of circumstance test that the parent, we look at this, but there's no special way to it.
All right. And what about the fact that here we have no parent and a mentally retarded child? Is there any authority for basically saying if you've got both of those conditions, then you have a situation that requires even more extreme steps to be taken to assure the voluntariness and the intelligence of the waiver?
I don't believe there's any authority in Delaware that says that in particular. I know there's just in general case law, Miranda, when there's an adult has suffers from a mental defect or mental retardation, that there's serious consideration as to finding that it was not a voluntary intelligent waiver. So if you apply the same standards of an adult to a juvenile, I think that could signal that that should be a factor, that should be especially considered. But the problem is how often is that going to be readily apparent to a police officer in the interrogation room without the parent? You actually would need a parent there to make sure that something like that is brought to police officer's attention. And I understand that's not always going to be the case, but at least there's a step in the right direction by having the parent there to assure that extra measure of protection. Even as in this case, at some point, the juvenile indicated to the police officer that he couldn't write. And that didn't prompt any questioning from the police officer at that point. You know, it would, should have been a signal to him that, okay, this is a 14-year-old boy and doesn't know how to write. Is there a learning disability here? At that point, the officer was merely just intent on getting his initials on the waiver form without any special concern of investigating that issue any further. And that's... So at minimum, I believe that under the totality of the circumstance test, even if this court does not go any further and it changed and applies either a more enhanced middle ground saying this factor should be heavily considered or goes even further and applies a per se test, even under the totality of the circumstance test that we have now, this was not a knowing, intelligent, voluntary waiver. So... that's our position, that even under conventional status of the law as it is, this statement should have been suppressed. But again, we have to determine, well, how can we prevent this problem from occurring again? And the situation is that it's going to happen again if the law stays the same. And
well, how would this work as a practical matter? The rule you're advocating is a parent would be in the room with the police officer during the interrogation. Both parents, or what if the parents can't be found? What if the parents disagree? How would it operate?
Well, There's many procedures you can apply. I think an approach would be that as soon as the juvenile is arrested, he has to be informed of his Miranda rights. He should be, at that point, they should inquire, get information where they can locate a parent, make a reasonable effort to locate a parent. When they locate the parent, advise the parent that they would like to question is the child and their presence is required. Now, the problem is what happens if you can't locate the parent? Well,
we had a case in the reported decision of State versus Marine where the parents were separated or divorced, and the mother retained an attorney and didn't want the son to speak to the police at all, and the father wanted the son to be completely truthful with the police. And then the police took an opportunity to conduct an interview when the child was with the father, and the mother and her lawyer found out and called in and tried to stop the interview.
I think in a situation where there's somebody retains counsel and an advisor and an attorney has been provided for the child, I think at that point that should be the paramount concern, that the attorney is now, the parent is now which child to talk to the police officer without an attorney. I don't think another parent should be able to override that, because that's because at that point.
Well, that was the ultimate conclusion in Marine.
Okay.
And do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Mr. Williams.
Good afternoon, Justice Holland, members of the court. May it please the court. I'll address the issue that was the subject of the supplemental briefing. The two issues that were originally raised on the appeal are certainly related, the suppression issue and the ultimate competency of this juvenile to be tried in the family court. I think the law has been fairly accurately summarized in the submissions and the comments so far. The status of the law is, at least in Delaware under the Haig or Hogg decision, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, basically follows the U.S. Supreme Court determination in FAIR. That is, a totality of the circumstance test is what is utilized in determining these type of suppression issues and waiver of Miranda rights and the ability of juveniles or any mentally impaired individual to waive rights. FAIR did deal with the juvenile. The majority of the state courts that have considered this issue adhere to that totality of the circumstances test. All the federal circuits that have addressed it also adhere to the totality of the circumstances test. The position being advocated on behalf of Mr. Smith, the interested adult or interested parent rule, is a distinct minority position. It's been adopted apparently by at least 10 states. Some have adopted it legislatively. Others have done it by case law. The state's position is that the totality of the circumstances is probably the best thing to use because people are different. Different factors are more important in one interrogation than in another. The trial judge certainly has the flexibility to give appropriate weight to whichever factors he or she thinks is most important in a particular case.
Mr. Williams.
Yes, Your Honor.
There are a number of rights that we deny those under 18. They can't contract. There are lots of consents they can't give. And we require that there be an adult there to protect their interests. Are we putting property rights above civil liberties? I think one could argue coherently that the civil liberty that's at stake here is far more important than the right to contract.
Well, I think that's probably true, but the context is whether or not the waiver of the Miranda rights is knowing, voluntary, and intelligent. So you still have to meet all of those hurdles. It's the state's burden. The state has to show by a preponderance of the evidence that there was a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. If the state can't do that, then, of course, the statement is suppressed.
Mr. Williams, what's the practice now under the Delaware statute where you have to contact a parent or, you know, an adult when you have a juvenile? And what are they told? What's the parent told and what's the child told? Are they told, for example, that you can be here during the interview? Or is the child told you can have your parent here during the interview? Or what's the purpose of the contact?
Well, I think the purpose, it's driven by statute. It's section 1004 in Title 10. It imposes an affirmative obligation on law enforcement authorities to attempt to locate. They have to make a good faith effort to locate
the
parent.
Well, my question is, if they do that and the parent says, I want to be there during the questioning, is that something that has to be honored?
Well, I don't know if it has to be honored, but I think that would certainly be a factor that a trial judge looking at a suppression motion would consider, that the parent made a specific request to be present. Here, James Smith's mother did not make any such request, and James Smith never asked that his mother be present when his taped statement was taken either. So I think, given the competing factors that are at issue here, if an interested adult or interested parent rule is going to be adopted, it's probably best left to the collective judgment of the legislature to resolve
that. My question is prompted by the suggestion that maybe there's an intermediate position and perhaps the legislature has already addressed it. If they're saying you need to contact the parent, is the logical extension of the statute that once you've contacted them, the parent can be present if the parent would like to be there, or the child can have the parent there? And the intermediate position would be simply tell the child, if you want your parent here, they can be here, or tell the parent, if you'd like to be with your child, you can be there.
Well, I think the obligation that's imposed is simply that the police have to make a good faith attempt to locate the parent or guardian. Now, logically, what flows from that, I guess, is if the parent or guardian is present, you know, then they can assert whatever rights they wish on behalf of the defendant.
No, but my question, you're talking about asserting the rights. My question is, would it be problematic to say that once you've contacted them, you have to tell the child and or the parent that the parent can be present?
Well, I don't know if you have to tell them that. I mean, there's certainly nothing in Miranda that requires that. And I think it's up to people to assert their rights if they don't want the child questioned or they want to be present. That's what Miranda entails. The child's told he doesn't have to say anything, and he can have an attorney present if he wants. And I think the question that's probably most apropos is, well, maybe fine to have your parent, but wouldn't you really be better off having a lawyer present? Because your parent may tell you, well, go ahead and tell the police officer exactly what he wants to know. It may be counterproductive for the child to actually have the parent present. And those are the kind of competing factors that I think should be legislatively resolved. If we're going to establish a bright line, hard and fast, per se rule that's going to it's going to govern police interrogation, because some of these are very serious cases. The Marine case was certainly a homicide case, the LaVon Walker case, another Kent County case. In that situation, they couldn't find any parent or guardian, and the question was, well, what are the police to do now? They have a statutory obligation. There's also a family court rule that imposes an obligation to make a good faith effort. In Mr. Walker's case, he was apprehended a day after the homicide, driving the homicide victim's car. And it was certainly highly suspicious circumstances, but he was a juvenile. And if the police were going to resolve this matter in any fashion, they needed to talk to Mr. Walker, but they could not get a parent or guardian to be physically present for the interrogation. So they did what they could and then proceeded with the interrogation.
Well, what you just said reminded me that I mentioned the Marine case to Mr. Rinzulli. It really was Bryant v. State, where the facts of that case where the parents disagreed. But let's look at the totality of the circumstances in this case and help us, you know, with our standard of review. My notes indicate that this juvenile was homesick, and the mother said, notwithstanding the fact that he was sick, he could come to the police station when the police said, well, if he's sick, why don't we come on another day? So we start out with a sick juvenile who's mentally retarded. And then as part of the competency hearing, Dr. Mensch says he has limited ability to make decisions regarding his own defense. He's going to have to rely heavily on an attorney, and the judge ultimately concludes the trial is going to have to be slowed down so he and his attorney can interact to conduct the trial properly. But yet, during the recitation of the Miranda rights, the police say, your mother said, this is okay. So in addition to the fact that he couldn't write, how does the fact that a sick, retarded person who has a limited mental ability to participate in their own defense, an expert psychiatrist says will be dependent on his attorney, is told his mother said, you can waive your rights, and can't write, make a knowing and intelligent waiver?
Well, again, it's the totality of the circumstances. And
well, how do the circumstances on the other side?
Well, the testimony from Dr. Mensch was that he was not psychotic. He didn't have any type of mental illness. That he was
but you,
able.
You agree he did say he has a limited ability to make decisions regarding his own defense?
Oh, certainly. And that's what Dr. Mensch said with Oliver Randolph, and he was found competent, too. His IQ was 10 points higher. But
well, we're not talking about standing trial. One of the big decisions about your own defense is whether you're going to confess. Right?
Yes, and he had in this case. I mean, that's what this case ultimately boils down to, and what was the attorney to do? Well, the complaining witness, who was 3 years old at the time of the sexual assault and was a kindergartner by the time of the trial, I mean, she testifies to these three incidents that are also admitted by Mr. Smith when he's interrogated. That's why the bottom line, really,
well,
on all this
that's
is
the harmless error analysis.
Certainly.
But my question is, in looking at the totality of the circumstances, what's on the other side of the equation that shows this mentally retarded sick person who couldn't write and had a limited ability to make decisions regarding their defense, nevertheless made a knowing and intelligent waiver?
Well, he is able to function. I mean, he goes to school. He's been in special ed his entire career, but he does attend school. That was the mother's decision as to whether or not he was well enough to come to the police station or not. Originally, when she said he had missed 2 days of school and he was in bed asleep and had been sick, the police said, fine, here's our card, call us when he's better. And they were actually leaving the motel when the mother approached them and said, he's awake now, he seems to be fine, he can at least get this done. And she wanted, I think as she put it, to get this matter resolved.
Well, what the trial judge said in this case in addressing that issue was, well, he wasn't so sick that he had to be carried in. Is that going to be the benchmark? If you're well enough to walk, then you're well enough to waive your Miranda rights?
Well, I think, again, you're just going to have to look at what the totality of the circumstances are. I mean, if he's taking medication, if he's falling asleep during the videotaped interview, you know, those are factors that certainly weigh against there being a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver. But if it's the fact that he has a cold and his nose is running or something like that, but he's still able to answer questions in a coherent fashion, well, that militates in the opposite direction. So, again, the best approach, I think, is the totality of the circumstances.
But again, and I may be repeating the question that Justice Holland asked, all or at least the great bulk of the circumstances weigh against voluntary waiver. Tell us again what the circumstances are that not only weigh in the opposite direction, but that would outweigh the circumstances against voluntary waiver.
Well, I think the most important thing is that he is a functioning person. I mean, he has a limited IQ. His full-scale IQ is 67. The mild mental retardation range is 50 to 70. So he's below the 70 range, but only by 3 points. His verbal IQ is actually above the 70-point mild retardation. It's a 76. When you compare that IQ, this quantitative factor that is available with some of the other people, I mean, we had Mr. Reed, which is an adult case in Kent County. The IQ in that individual was a 64. That's certainly lower than Mr. Smith here. And he was deemed to be competent to stand trial. So I think you have to look at that. You have to look at how the person functions. And when you have a taped interview, the this was a non-jury trial. The family court judge can view the tape, which she did, and make assessments from the tape. It's the best evidence as to what actually happened.
There are two circumstances. One is that he was functional in the sense that that although he had a subnormal IQ, it was still slightly above the bottom range. And secondly, his demeanor, as shown on the videotape and viewed by the trial judge.
Yes, and I think Dr. Mensch also said he didn't have any mental illness. He wasn't psychotic. He didn't have any other mental illness. So, you know, that's out of the equation. We're just talking about his ability of intellectual functioning here. He is able to hold a conversation, Dr. Mensch conceded, and he is able to answer questions in a coherent fashion.
My question relates to the interplay between competency and the waiver of Miranda. And there were two separate decisions in this case, and there are two separate issues on appeal. Let's assume that he was competent. As part of the competency determination, the judge concluded, and Dr. Mensch testified, that he would be able to cooperate with his attorney, but he would have to rely on his attorney, and that the trial would have to be slowed down, and he'd have this limited ability to participate in decisions about his defense. So notwithstanding the fact that he's competent, he's got all of these other concerns that weigh in favor of reliance upon an attorney. But yet when it came time to waive Miranda, part of the colloquy was, your mother said it's okay, and he decides to confess without his mother or an attorney, when the competency determination says he's going to have real limited ability to make those types of decisions.
Well, I think that's all true, but in deciding the competency, that's one of the factors. But the other two factors are, does he have a rational and factual understanding of what's going on? And Dr. Mensch did indicate that he understood, you know, that there were charges being pressed against him and that he would have a lawyer at the trial and that the lawyer's job was to help him. So in terms of those competency factors for purposes of standing trial, he was competent, and that's what the trial judge found. I think there isn't any indication that he wasn't competent to do that. You have to really look at what this case was about. What it boiled down to for the defense attorney was he was going to have to, if he could, on cross-examination, try to budge the complaining witness off of her story, because if the judge found her story, her account of what happened, credible, and she didn't find anything to contradict that, that was going to be the end of the matter. And that's why, even if things should have been done differently in terms of the Miranda warnings and the determination by the trial judge about the sufficiency of the waiver, it's ultimately harmless error in this case, because he didn't really admit to anything that the complaining witness didn't testify to. So there was more than sufficient evidence at trial to convict him of the three charges. The only real difference was that the complaining witness said it happened in a different area in her home than the accused did.
I'd like to get back to one of your earlier comments that the state takes the position that the totality of the circumstances test is the one that should be applied and continue to be applied in Delaware. This case is probably not the only one, but this case is certainly one where the absence of the parent in the room and perhaps the absence of an extra effort to explain to the child his rights could turn out to jeopardize the admissibility of the confession, and although you argue harmless error, ultimately it could jeopardize the conviction altogether. Wouldn't it be, from the state's perspective, better to have more well-defined standard, maybe even within a totality of the circumstances test, that would specify what factors would get more weight and or what factors would help insulate against a claim of the absence of a voluntary waiver?
Well, I don't know that having a specialized test that assigns a specific weight to one factor or another is going to be that helpful. I think it's better left to the trial judge's discretion to look at all the circumstances. It may be in a particular case that another.
I recall in Bryan versus State when the lawyer was trying to reach Bryan, and I went back. Well, I guess Bryan was a sequel to Weber, but ultimately our court held that if your lawyer's trying to reach you during an interrogation and you're not told that your lawyer's trying to reach you, then there's going to be a presumption that what you did was not knowing and intelligent or voluntary. And would a similar rule make sense in this case, that if a juvenile is going to confess in the absence of a parent, maybe there should be a presumption that it wasn't knowing, intelligent, and voluntary?
No, I don't think so, because the the problem with the presumptions is usually the exception comes along and then it the efficacy of having the presumption really doesn't make logical sense. It may be in a situation that you may have a similarly situated defendant like Mr. Smith, who has the same type of IQ or learning problems, but he's very experienced in the criminal justice system. He's been interrogated numerous times by the police, and while he may not be able to articulate all of these things as a more educated person could, he knows exactly what's going on and exactly what's at stake. And having the totality of the circumstances allows the trial judge to say, well, yes, he has a limited intellectual capacity. There's no parent that was present here. I mean, we've had situations where the parents have been called and the parents refuse to come to the police station. And they just say, no, go ahead and ask them whatever questions you want. The trial judge, if he has the flexibility, can weigh the different factors. Some may be more important in one case than in another. I think assigning any specific weight to one or the other or making that determinative is probably not going to be in the best interest of justice here. If the legislature thinks it's such a bad situation, the legislature can certainly act. Other states' legislatures have acted to enact this interested adult or interested parent rule. And if that's the best approach, well, let the legislature determine that and decide it. But I think at this point, certainly the federal courts agree that the totality of the circumstances is a better way to do it, not emphasizing one particular factor over another exclusively, but allowing the judge to give what weight he or she thinks is most appropriate under particular circumstances in a case. If there's any additional questions, I'll try to answer those. Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Picking up on that last point, whether this is something that should be left to the General Assembly, it's the history of Miranda has always been that this is something that whether a waiver of some juvenile's constitutional rights, this is something that the courts have always considered within their providence to decide. And it's clear from the history in Delaware that this court has previously considered the problem in Torres and Marine case, and at that point there was no concern whether to defer this matter to the legislature. I mean, it's within the history of Miranda that the courts generally resolve this issue.
Well, if we ruled as you would like us to do, if the U.S. Supreme Court in FAIR has developed a rule, that's the rule under the U.S. Constitution. Are you advocating a rule under the Delaware Constitution, or what? What is it?
Well, the courts in Delaware can always grant more rights and protections beyond those that are set by the U.S. Supreme Court. I mean, it's always generally recognized that generally that sets the floor, but not the ceiling. And that's why many states have extended, gone beyond the Supreme Court's decision in FAIR and these other jurisdictions that have considered the per se rule. There is...
Was this argued to the trial court?
I believe the trial court did not raise We didn't argue the adoption of the per se rule at the trial court. We did argue that the parent wasn't present. That is something that we are looking into at this point. But the issue whether that this is should only be left to the General Assembly, I think is nothing that there's nothing in the Delaware Constitution I've seen and prior decisions in it that I've cited in my memorandum that indicates that this is something that this court has a history of deferring to, especially when it comes to the issue of the waiver of individual rights.
Well, in the minute that you have left, tell us why, if there was an error, it was not harmless in view of the victim's testimony.
Well, it's important to remember that during the competency hearing, the judge considered the statement as part of her decision. It was integrated in her decision that, based on his answers there, I have a finding of fact that he's capable of making rational answers. If this statement is suppressed, then this court will have to substitute facts in order to determine, in place of what the judge used as a factual basis for finding that this juvenile is capable of making rational answers. When you eliminate that factor, then that seriously undermines her position as to finding the juvenile competent. This is probably what should have happened. Dr. Mensch seriously indicated that this juvenile had major cognitive deficiencies that were chronic, and on that basis alone, this juvenile should not have been found competent. My light's on. So.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement, and we will also recess.